You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 128, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today's episode is going to run a little bit long, but last week it was a little bit short, so this will be a nice way to sort of even things out. And is a fantastic interview. I speak with Dr. Hooman Norchasm. Not the easiest name to say, but super smart guy. He's an immunologist, former cardiothoracic surgeon. We're going to go a little bit into his background history, but he's going to talk today about vaccinations and people who have been previously infected and what they should do about vaccination. I get this question all the time when I'm at the hospital from other hospital staff, nurses, physicians, and they'll say, you know, I had COVID or my kids had COVID. Do they need to get vaccinated? What do you think? And I've always told them, well, you know, the CDC, FDA recommends that you just go ahead and do it. It's never made a whole lot of sense to me, but yeah, that's what the recommendation is from the experts. And Dr. Norchasm, who has a degree in immunology, his graduate work, super well-versed, I think he lays out a very compelling case for why he's concerned about this policy. But we're going to get into that, and I think you're going to find a great show, and it's going to be really informative, and I'm super excited, and I'm so thankful that he was on. He's been on a number of other shows like Tucker Carlson. He's written extensively at Medium.com. You'll find him also on Twitter, where he rails against people who are using non-scientific approaches, let's say, to combat the virus. But also he is someone who believes in vaccinations and that's an effective treatment. So it's not like this is someone who is ideologically compelled to think one way or the other. He just says it's time for us to use some science. And really we've lacked scientific discovery, the curiosity and the skepticism. And I don't know if skepticism is even the right word, but probably just the questioning of things and making sure that we all agree that we're down the right path. And the acceptance that other people may have varying beliefs or theories, hypotheses, and that we just have to accept that, you know, we don't know for sure. There's a lot of hubris in those who are leaders, and there's not much humility. And I've said way from the start, back in last March even, that you have to have a large level of humility in this whole debate to really understand where we should go, what we should do. There will be links to all of Dr. Norchasm's stuff that I have access to, Tucker Carlson's interview, some of his writings at Medium, his Twitter handle, and there's other shows that relate to this about COVID, which we've had quite a few now in the Paradox recently. But that all can be found at theparadox.com/128. I encourage you again to share this show with your friends. It is what makes this show so popular and so successful. And I can't thank you enough for really spreading the word and pushing this to your friends and people you think may find something useful, not only just about COVID. Hopefully you find a lot more about this show useful than COVID. But we talk about other things with the U.S. healthcare delivery system, problems that we face, and people who have found solutions to things. So I encourage you to share the show. Go back in the archives if you haven't listened to a bunch. find a couple that you think might be interesting at the right of the titles. Make sure you subscribe to the show. And please, if you have an opportunity, go to a 5-star rating on whatever podcast player you use. But first, before we start the interview, a word from our sponsor. Today's sponsor is Michael L. Revis. He is a CFP professional and insurance agent committed to helping physicians nationwide with their term life and disability insurance needs. He provides an objective, transparent, and education-focused process that aims to help physicians make prudent decisions and avoid overcomplicating things. He exclusively offers own occupational disability insurance policies for residents, fellows, and attending physicians. We know he'd be happy to help you with whatever your needs are. You can find Michael at drpodcastnetwork.com/mrinsurance or contact him directly at 1-800-817-4522. And now, without further ado, Dr. Huma Norchasm and why you shouldn't get vaccinated if you've had COVID-19. Enjoy. Well, hey, I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Huma Norchasm. He's a physician, immunologist, and public health advocate in the Philadelphia area. And we're going to talk about COVID-19. So, Dr. Norchasm, thanks so much for joining me.
Eric, thank you very much for having me. It's nice to be with you.
We were chatting a little bit beforehand, so I got a little bit of your background. But if you could just talk to the audience, and we're going to talk about COVID-19, immunology, obviously. I've had Dr. David Graham, my friend, who's an infectious disease physician. So we've talked about sort of the evolutionary expectations for coronaviruses and sort of how they behave. But we haven't talked much in this show about the immunological aspects of things, antibodies, vaccination, things like that. So I'd like to get into that today. But if you could sort of talk briefly about your educational background in immunology and as a physician, and then how you became an advocate for the vaccine positions you have, and then we'll kind of get into the specifics.
Sure. Eric, thanks again for having me. As you said, I'm a physician immunologist. I did my undergrad just by way of an educational background. I did my undergrad at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Went to medical school at Penn and was in the combined degree program there and the MD-PhD program under a medical scientist training program grant from the NIH. And after I finished my PhD, which took about 9 years, I did a postdoctoral fellowship in immunology. For about 2 years, joined the faculty at Penn before starting my general surgery residency. And, you know, I did a general surgery residency at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and afterwards went up to Harvard Medical School's Brigham and Women's to do my cardiovascular fellowship. And that took us to about 2013. And in 2013, my wife, who also was a physician scientist and immunologist, was an anesthesiologist just like yourself and a critical care doc. And she and I went up to Boston from Philadelphia, and she was a faculty member at Beth Israel Deaconess, Harvard Medical School. And in 2013, she was unfortunately diagnosed with a cancer of the uterus. And the story is pretty public. I mean, she basically, these cancers of the uterus were being misdiagnosed by gynecologists, and a medical device was being used on these tumors to get the enlarged fibroid tumors out of a small incision. And in the process, the tumors were being minced, and if there was cancer in these tumors, the cancer would, you know, spread mechanically in the abdominal cavities of these women. And stage one contained cancer would almost instantaneously turn into a stage four cancer. This was happening at a rate of 1 in 350 to 400 in women with symptomatic fibroids that were being assumed to be benign. So we really came face to face with this concept of minority harm in medicine, where, you know, you have a practice pattern that's benefiting the majority, or somehow it's economically viable as a service line. And, you know, there's some minority harm being done at some rate of less than 1%, and it's being justified and sort of, you know, not nefariously being whitewashed, but just being ignored as sort of being less than 1% and therefore justified. But in reality, when you tally up the numbers, you know, if you do a procedure a million times a year, and 1 out of 350 women are getting their cancers upstaged, you're talking about a couple of plane loads full of women getting their cancers upstaged. So you can't really ignore it. And so that perspective, you know, of minority harm is what Amy and I sort of brought to a very big, large scale public health fight. And I would invite your audience to check it out in the press. There was actually a documentary movie made about my wife's public health battle called Kicking the Hornet's Nest, which is on Amazon. It's a very well done documentary movie by a young filmmaker. Really, it was a labor of love for him, and he spent about 6 years building this movie. So I would invite you and your audience to really check it out, because it really crystallizes how it's an example of how minority harm is born in our medical establishment and how it's sustained. And so that perspective is sort of what reemerged for me as our nation started to engage this pandemic and the vaccine became the dominant pathway to rescue out of this. I think there are very many parallels where, in the vaccine space, we're approaching this in a one-size-fits-all way, and that's where harm lives to minority subsets of people. So that's I think, what we want to talk about on your show here. So sorry.
Exactly. No, that's perfect. And this is the subject I find very complicated when talking to patients or talking to other physicians, and because I think in general, people, humans, and probably for good reason, not very good at assessing risk levels as far as percentages. Like if I say somebody has a 37% risk of happening, mm-hmm. it's really hard for people to grasp what that means, or of 3% or 0.5%, right? One in 200, one in 300, right? And for you're talking with somebody that's almost like one in four, 1.25%, right? Is one in 400. And what does that really mean? And so I will, when I try to describe things to people, patients, what's the chance of this happening versus this happening, getting a sore throat with a general anesthetic. You have to sort of give, people can kind of guess 10% or something or 25%, but really rare events, one in 10,000, one in a million, you really can't ever put your finger on what that really means. People don't really grasp it. And you definitely see that, I think, with risk assessment from the public and from the press in COVID, that it's really hard for people to understand what the real risks for certain things are. And then it makes it really difficult to make a decision on what's the right thing to do. And I always say, fundamentally, your risk is either zero or it's 100. And unfortunately, I can't tell you which one it is, right? I mean, I'd say it's almost for sure zero, but it could be the 100, you could be that 100%. And so I think that's always important to point out that it's really, we're just not very good at it.
Well, you're right. Physicians. So, that's a very important topic. And I've spent a lot of time over the past 8 years since my wife's complication really thinking about it. And I think it comes down to, I think that most of us make this error in both in medicine as well as in the public of thinking about risk in terms of numbers, where you're absolutely right. We have absolutely no framework for how to assess whether that risk is large enough. For example, with the morcellation idea, look, the risk is one in 350. That's true. But if you're doing it on a million people, what's 0.25% of a million people, right? Suddenly you start seeing the jetliners filled with people crashing, right? And if you saw that, I mean, that's the problem with public health is that when a hazard is spread over time and space, you don't necessarily see it. Whereas when a plane crashes and, 200 people on board all perish, you actually see what that is. So for example, like the 737 MAX Boeing jets a couple of years ago, two planes went down and 346 people perished. If you look at the actual mortality risk in those aircraft, it's probably one in millions, right? I mean, one right. in millions of passenger miles traveled, but because you actually see it, every one of us could viscerally react to a plane crashing, right? But with the morcellator, the risk is one in 350 and it's happening like sort of spread out over time and space. And so you can't see it. So really it's, I think, the framework that we think about risk is not sort of adjudicated appropriately at this point in our evolution as a specialty and as a society. And I think what it comes down to in medicine is two things. It's not really the incidence, I think, that matters. What matters is two things. Number one is the idea of medical necessity. So if you're doing, are you doing something to someone? Are you offering them a treatment because it's actually necessary either for their, physical or psychological well-being, A, and B, whether you're taking every step possible to avoid avoidable risks, right? So in other words, can you identify who's at risk and can you mitigate and avoid the risk, right? And the answer to those questions is, well, it's medically necessary and beneficial, A, what you're doing, and B, that you're taking every step possible to identify risks and to mitigate against them or to avoid them, then it's not really the incidence of the risk that matters. If you haven't done those, you're actually not in ethical space for medical practice because, as you know, the principles of medical ethics tell us that beneficence is one of the pillars of medical ethics. You have to be doing something that benefits your patient. You know, benefits your patient is benefiting. And B, you have to, you have to be doing this with an idea of informed consent. And if you're not doing those, if you're not mitigating against harm, then you're just simply not in ethical space. So that it's really not the incidence, I think, that we should focus on. It should be the avoidability of a risk.
Right. And I don't speak Latin, but I know it's a primum non nocere, right? It's like first do no harm. And to your point, it's like if someone comes in a trauma and they're dying in front of you, even if you're doing things that are going to cause harm, you don't worry about it because the greater harm, of course, is death. And so that's a situation where you say, well, we've done everything we can to prevent worse harm.
Yeah.
And right. But, you know, so well, but,
even in that case, Eric, like I can tell you that, like, for example, and I know that your audience is you know, partly medical, so I can use this example. You know, for example, with aortic injuries, right? Recently, there's this push towards using this device that's minimally invasive called the REBOA, you know, where you're essentially inflating a balloon inside the aorta to stop bleeding. This has replaced the standard of care, which was to do an XLAP or a thoracotomy to gain direct control of the aorta when it's bleeding, right? Now, I mean, here's the thing. No one's ever done any non-inferiority studies on that thing, right? But people are using it extremely, I don't know how it is in your medical center, but they're using it pretty, you know, pretty liberally, you know? We don't really know if the REBOA device for controlling a trauma situation, right, where someone's bleeding to death from an aortic injury, right, is actually more effective or not, right, than the standard approach, which is to do an XLAP, or potentially take the patient to the IR suite. So, you know, these are things that we sort of don't, you know, we're not, you know, the economics and the sort of the sexy new approaches are really overriding our clinical ethics. So I think we're really in dangerous territory right now, you know, with technology.
So, yeah, and I think that's a great point. There's all kinds of things we do that I'm like, I don't really know this is of any benefit to the patient outside of like the bottom line of the hospital or the surgeon thinks it's fun or something like that, right? I mean, but we're not going to talk about that. Which we could obviously go and talk about this for quite a while. So let's talk about vaccinations. And I'm not sure where to start, but I guess I'll just say, you know, we did an episode here with my friend Dr. Graham in episode 86. That was back in April of 2020. So, I mean, that's like right in the beginning of this thing. And I mean, that's where I was actually idle as far as working because they closed down the ORs, the entire state of Michigan shut down for the surge that outside of Southeast Michigan never came. Like we were closed down and our, you know, tumbleweed going through the hospital. It was people, the ER kept getting food delivered and they're like, we feel guilty because there's nobody here. Right. I mean, it was, and I'm not going to blame anyone for the situation. It was no one understood it, but even Dr. Graham and I were talking at that time. And I felt like at that point we sort of had some feel for how this was going to play out. And it's played out pretty much the way we thought it was going to play out, which is interesting because I never saw it talked about anywhere as far as we moved from pandemic to endemic. And you had and the one thing we did not anticipate was a vaccine. I think I think you've stated in some other interviews I've seen that it's pretty much a miraculous vaccine. I mean, what has been developed, the speed with which it's developed and its effectiveness, and it works really great. But the question I get all the time in the OR and from other nurses, and because I have the show, they think I'm an authority on things, which I'm more authority than some others, maybe because I've talked about people. But they ask me the question, all right, I had COVID, my husband had COVID or my kids did, or, you know, do I get vaccinated? Because there's absolutely a push within the media and certainly within the governments, the United States, state governments, but also even with the institutions, with the hospitals. They can't require it because it's an emergency use authorization, but they can change time off requirements. Like, well, if you get sick and you have to stay home because of quarantine rules, but if you've not been vaccinated, we're not going to pay you. But if you've been vaccinated, you're going to get paid. But they may have a documented case of COVID.
Or when you think about educational environments, right now there's a lot of talk about colleges mandating vaccination. Otherwise, kids don't have their educational opportunities. You know, one of the efforts that I've been engaged in is this idea of convincing universities, you know, that they can't mandate this vaccine. And you know, as you said, one of the main issues is, you know, as we've switched from pandemic to endemic, as many millions of people are actually infected, does it even make sense to be vaccinating people who are already immune naturally, right? It certainly doesn't make sense in the setting of any other of the infectious, you know, canonical infectious diseases that we think about, right? But in this case, it seems like there's this massive one-size-fits-all approach to vaccinating the living hell out of everyone, irrespective of whether or not they're actually, you know, naturally immune. And I think this is a major error. So you're absolutely right. I mean, about a year ago, I wrote an article, and I like to write my articles in a way that actually engages the general public and not just medical professionals, especially on medium.com. And your audience is welcome to peruse what I've written on medium.com. But, you know, one of the articles that I wrote early in the pandemic was about this idea that we're probably not going to see a vaccine for about a year and a half at least, right? So you're absolutely right. It was completely, it's a miracle of modern medicine, right? That we have these mRNA vaccines. They're highly effective, right? But as we sort of moved into this space where it's like this, now here we have this vaccine and it's going to save the day, right? It became a one size fits all, you know, for our public health officials, where it's almost this mindless approach to vaccinating everyone, irrespective of the fact that we're in the middle of an outbreak where many people are already infected recently. I mean, you and I both know that, you know, no self-respecting physician would vaccinate someone who's actually has an active infection, because you know that the vaccine could actually make the condition worse. And particularly in the case of an inflammatory process, which is what COVID causes. And then the second thing is, you know, a lot of folks have recovered. And by definition, you know, by standard of care in medicine, these folks have serological evidence of immunity. So to take someone who has serological evidence of immunity and give them a vaccine that's essentially, as you said, essentially an experimental sort of technique. I mean, you know that, you and I both know it takes about 10 years to develop a vaccine, right? We've developed this vaccine in under a year. There clearly are subsets of people missing from the safety and efficacy trials. People, you know, for example, pregnant women were missing from these safety trials, right? So here we are just liberally delivering this vaccine to everyone in a setting where millions of people are already infected, are already immune. And my opinion as an immunologist is, right, that this is an error. This is a public health error, because really when you do something unnecessary to folks, as we talked about a couple of minutes ago, if you're doing something unnecessary to people, meaning if a person is immune and you're delivering a vaccine to them to immunize them, well, they're already immune, so they stand no chance of benefiting, or very little chance of benefiting, right? And so really the only thing you're selling that patient or giving that patient is the possibility of harm. And for anyone who to think that this vaccine is perfectly safe, well, you know, that person is delusional, because nothing in medicine is perfectly safe, right? I mean, even the tubes that you put down people's throats, you know, like for to intubate them, these are not, yeah, I mean, they're very effective. And in the vast majority of people in the hands of good anesthesiologists, these are safe. But you and I both know that there's a risk of harm associated with this. So you better damn well need to intubate your patient before you intubate them. If you don't need to intubate someone and you intubate them and they get hurt from a complication that's associated with that procedure, then you've actually done harm. You haven't, it's not just an unavoidable complication anymore. It's actually harm, because it's not medically necessary. And my contention to the FDA has been fundamentally that if a person is naturally immune, if by every standard measure serologically, we can demonstrate that this person is immune, they have IgG antibodies, they had symptomatic disease, it makes absolutely no sense, zero sense, to vaccinate these people indiscriminately. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, I've been stunned. And that was that was the message early on. And I don't know why. I mean, I'm assuming the thinking was, if we try and work too slowly, we're not going to get people vaccinated, right? Like, the most important thing right now is to push this vaccine, get as many people vaccinated to drive down the numbers, which absolutely makes sense. That's totally logical. But the thought was that if you add an extra step in checking if someone's actually had the virus, you know, and cleared it, that you would, you know, especially when it was a precious resource. I mean, yeah. Now it's not so much. Now we have got more supply than we have demand. But initially, it made no sense, of course, to vaccinate people who'd had it. But it was like there's not even time to try and check that, or it's going to add an extra level of confusion, and people are not going to get it, or people thought they had it and they're never going to really get checked, and so they're going to say, well, I had it, and you know
and that's absolutely, I mean, you know, I think fundamentally what it comes down to is that our public health officials and a lot of establishment experts essentially don't seem to believe that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? I mean, for God's sake, we put a rover on Mars, right? And you know, like, you know, in terms of the sophistication of things that we're capable of, I mean, this idea that we can't rationally sort of disperse this vaccine and efficiently and actually stick with what we know and the principles of ethics and science and clinical medicine that we know, I think there's a fundamental level of disrespect for everyday Americans that's ingrained in it. I mean, I think it's absolutely arrogant on the part of our public health officials and establishment folks to assume, you know, that average Americans don't understand this concept. In fact, what I've found, Eric, is, you know, I interact a lot with, you know, everyday folks in the community. Everyday Americans actually understand this. Like, really, it's stunning to me.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, people, like, average people who've had, you know, levels of education that are you know, on par with the average in this country, come up to me and say, you know, I had COVID. you know, do I really need to, I mean, that what you're saying makes sense. Do I really need to get this? And the answer is, well, most likely not. And here, you know, here, you can have a prescription and go get your IgG levels drawn at LabCorp. And if you're positive, just like any other infectious disease, I mean, this virus is, there's nothing special about this virus. I mean, it's a transient virus. It's not like a herpes virus or an HIV type virus, right? It doesn't incorporate, it's a transient virus that comes and goes, neutralizing antibodies and prime T cells work against it. And so if you're serologically positive for IgG, that means you have neutralizing antibodies and prime T cells, you know? It's really stunning. It really, really is that we're doing this.
So what could you say to people when they ask you, all right, are you certain that once I've cleared the virus that I'm immune, or how long is it going to last? I mean, what do you tell people like that? Because I think that's the next question. Like, well, I had it back in last April and it's been over a year now. What do you say to people?
So there's a very large study that just came out in preprint form from Israel, and it's actually a credible study from a major medical center. The numbers were about 4.6 million people, you know, in the group that they retrospectively looked at. And what they found, I mean, you can look this up. I think it's from Tel Aviv University. What they found is that people who have had infections, natural infections, and natural immunity are as well protected as vaccinated people from development of subsequent reinfection. So that's a very large study, and it sort of makes sense from the perspective of, I mean, we could have predicted this, right? So I would, first of all, I would point to that study that says, look, within a 3 to 6 month period, you know, people who are naturally infected and people who are vaccinated are equally protected. In terms of how long it lasts, look, my scientific, you know, my immunological guess, as an intelligent guess, is that the vast majority of people who've been naturally infected are going to have long-term immunity, because, you know, T cell and plasma cell, you know, maturation and formation is not a random thing. It's not like a on-off switch, like, you know, oh, it's on now, then it goes off. So I think the vast majority of these folks are going to have long-term immunity. You know, it's a pandemic that's a year old. It's a vaccine that's only a couple of, you know, so we're going to have time to look at it. But really, on the front end of this thing, this idea that we're going to just like jam this vaccine down everyone's throats and take people's civil liberties away, mandated in colleges, and take people's educational opportunities away from them, or come up with some sort of vaccine passport that is going to be a disaster for equity and inclusion and civil rights. You know, these ideas are so draconian and so totalitarian in nature and so unethical, you know. It's just shocking that you know, any self-respecting physician or public health expert in the United States in the year 2021 would go for it. I think it has to do with groupthink. You know, we got to break out of this groupthink thing and really, you know, level with each other and respect people, respect everyday Americans. You know, just because we have MDs and PhDs doesn't mean we know better. You know, actually, the average Joe knows better, frankly. You know,
you know, I totally agree. And I've talked about vaccine passports too, and how I think it's not, it won't work from a civil liberty standpoint. Obviously it's a disaster, but it's also a disaster from a, you know, utility purpose. It's also of no utility in this. By the time they actually develop it, it will be long past the part where you need to really get worried and concerned in this country.
You know, Eric, I had a conversation with Tucker Carlson on Fox Nation a couple of weeks ago. It was a pretty good interview. You know, he interviewed me for an hour, and we chatted about this. You know, I think it's going to be these vaccine passports are going to be a disaster in equity and inclusion and civil rights, you know. And not only that, look, you know, here's the thing. We can't even get our voting, you know, paperwork straight in this country, right? Do you think, I mean, like, who do you actually think is gonna suffer disproportionately from not being able to get these vaccine passports or immunity passports? It's gonna be the same people who have disadvantages in terms of their voting rights, right? So I'm not understanding how people who are like yelling and screaming about voting rights are suddenly now all for this passport. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, we got to turn on our brains a little bit here, you know.
Do you think the people at the FDA and CDC, do they understand immunity? I mean, like what you say, it makes sense. Like, that seems to be the general understanding. You've had chickenpox, you don't vaccinate the kid for chickenpox. Like when the vaccine first came out, they didn't, you know, that was one of the questions, right? Like if you've had it, include it. Now, we don't know how long the vaccine is effective for. We don't know how long. Well, we're pretty sure that lifetime immunity is pretty much lifetime immunity. I think there's the very rare person who gets it later in life, but I think we know that's super rare. Do they just not understand that? Is it willful ignorance? I mean, I'm trying to understand what you think. you know, get in their brains. I mean, what do you think is at work here? Or do they think public officials won't understand it? The public won't understand it. So we're just gonna make it super dumb and simple, and then that's just how we're gonna push it forward.
I think part of it is a McDonald's approach, but I do think there's a systemic problem going on in at the FDA, and that is that, you know, the entire sort of narrative is being crafted by primarily by virologists, actually, and these are essentially Dr. Fauci's crowd, and you know, I think I have a lot of respect for Dr. Fauci. I mean, I worked at the NIH in Bob Gallo's lab back in the early 90s when Dr. Fauci was sort of at the peak of his rise as our top infectious disease specialist, and you know, they learned a lot of lessons from the HIV pandemic, obviously, but you know, I think what's happening is that there's sort of a it's almost like this you know, non-diverse scientific approach to this virus that's being guided primarily by virologists who sort of grew up in the HIV era, right? And HIV is a fundamentally different virus than SARS-CoV-2. SARS-CoV-2 is a transient virus. HIV incorporates itself into your genome and is there forever, right? When it infects you, right? So they're fundamentally different things. And so the approach that they took to anti-replication agents and B, vaccines and neutralizing agents really came from that sort of mindset. So there's nothing nefarious going on, but I do think that the folks who are working on this are not cellular immunologists. Like Dr. Fauci does not think about inflammatory process the same way I would, or the same way someone like Professor Carl June at Penn would, right? Like the activation dynamics of T cells and macrophages, right? And so I think that there's a fundamental sort of lopsided approach to this virus where all eggs have been put in one basket with the vaccine. And really, you know, what we've dominantly ignored is the fact that this COVID-19 disease is actually an inflammatory disease. You know, it's not a surprise. The only therapy that we have for COVID-19 disease is dexamethasone, right? And that's an anti-inflammatory drug. Where did it come from? It didn't come from the United States. It came from the UK, right? And the reason for that is because we've dominantly sort of focused on the vaccine effort and on these like sexy newfangled drugs that are neutralizing agents like the Regeneron antibodies. And a lot of it is just sort of plugged into money interests. And so therefore what you get is a collusion between money interests and a scientific approach that's just lopsided because Dr. Fauci is a virologist, you know? So I think we have a scientific monarchy in place, right? That's guiding our nation's narrative, right? And I think in America, you know, you can't have a monarchy, right? So you have to bring in other people who have different ideas. And you know, this vaccine issue is exactly that. That I think that's why we have a problem with the vaccine right now.
Yeah. So. Well, it's been no surprise for me. I thought Fauci has done a really terrible job from the start of this pandemic and messaging and explaining things. And I think just overall, I don't know, I think just treating people as idiots, and whether they're physicians or the American public. And it shows how they've lost so much institutional support from lots of Americans. I mean, they're the ones who are 100% in favor. And then there are ones who just don't believe anything they say at this point. And I don't know, you can get that public trust back for a generation, but.
I think the way you get public trust back is by, you know, being humble and decent and actually addressing people's concerns, you know. And you know, like one of the things that I learned from the whole issue of that my wife struggled with, Eric, was that, you know, everyday people understood far more profoundly that there's a serious problem than all kinds of people with MDs and PhDs and academic regalia. I mean, I think that there's this level of hubris that's been brewing in our system, you know, in our establishment, in our arena, and in our academic institutions. That simply, basically, looks at everyday Americans and says, "We know better than you do." And I'm not saying that science doesn't reveal things that are not revealed to the average person. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, expertise don't mean anything. They clearly do. You know, you don't want to put like someone who's, you know, a doorman, you know, or like a receptionist in a cardiac surgical operating room and say, okay, go ahead and do the CABG, right? You can't do that, right? But you know, the fundamental facts are that there is a layer, a level at which the public actually do have an understanding and should be given the tools that they need to understand what they're dealing with. And if you just sort of do this stick and carrot thing, I mean, I go on CNN and there's this lady on there. She's a public health expert, so-called, you know, I guess her name is Dr. Wen or something. You know, she talks about a stick and carrot approach, taking Americans' freedoms away from them or giving them freedom if they get the vaccine, right?
Right.
Well, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard. It's not just stupid, it's totalitarian and it's dangerous, right? Because it fundamentally disrespects the everyday American, which we cannot have as an orientation, as a profession, right? I mean, as a profession, as a healing profession, one of our tenets of operation is patient autonomy, which essentially means that you respect the patient's intelligence and understanding, and you can't force anything on anyone, right? So we've lost that humility, right? We're willing to override the principle of beneficence in medical ethics by vaccinating people who are already immune. We're willing to override the principle of patient autonomy, right? Which basically means we respect the patient's decision over their own body, right? And if we're willing to do that, that means we're arrogant, right? And if Dr. Fauci is willing to let that happen, that means he's arrogant, right? And I have all due respect for Dr. Fauci. I understand his pedigree and everything, right? But I just think it's being terribly mishandled, and you know, it's doing harm. It's doing harm.
And now we're looking. So I mean, we've kind of talked about civilians, but another big population. I don't know how big it is, but I think it's a couple million. As you look at service members in the U.S. military, and they have, I imagine they have much less control over what happens to them. Right. And is this being pushed on them as well? Because I know a lot of them are young. They're probably either A, not worried about the virus, which I think is, again, that's up to each individual to sort of decide what their concern level is. But but also a lot of them have probably had it, especially in their quarters. So they're kind of at risk, right, from just getting this a vaccination that will provide no benefit. And yes, the harm is incredibly small, as we stated before, but again, it's either 0 or 100, right? So,
right.
What do you think?
Yeah, I'm actually as you're speaking, I'm pulling up an article that I posted on Facebook. I wrote a letter to President Biden about the service members because the Department of Defense policy is that everyone should get vaccinated at this point, right? And they're offering the vaccine to all the troops, right? And as you said, many of them are actually already infected. So there was actually an article. You know, you can pull up my letter to President Biden. You know, it's several thousand people have read it at this point. But basically, the point is this: is if your service members are recently infected or immune, these are folks who can't benefit and will only get harmed. So I'm just pulling this up. It's in the Military Times. The title of it is 25th service member dies of COVID-19 as White House considers mandatory vaccines. Right. So this gentleman's name was Senior Chief Fire Controlman Michael Wilson. He's 45 years old. He's assigned to the Information Warfare Training Command, Virginia Beach, Virginia, died of a coronavirus-related complication after being fully vaccinated, okay? So you know, I think, you know, we can say these are true and unrelated, right? We can say, okay, you know, this senior chief Wilson died from COVID, and that's what they're saying. Like that orthopod, Dr. J. Barton Williams of Memphis, Tennessee, you know, he'd had an asymptomatic infection, got his two Pfizer vaccines, and he burned up in an ICU and died from a hyperinflammatory reaction. And FDA and CDC are saying that's true and unrelated. So yes, true, he had the asymptomatic infection, true, he got the vaccine, and true, he died, but these are unrelated events, right? I mean, we can do that, right? But you know, I think that's not the sort of ethical and scientifically and clinically sound way to go. These are all sentinel events, right? And so yes, in the military right now, what we're doing is we have a group of folks who are committed to nation and duty, and they will do whatever the government tells them to. And many of them are actually recently infected or are currently immune. And so if the United States government policy, if the White House comes in and says, no, go ahead, we're gonna vaccinate all you guys with a blanket carte blanche, right? And one out of however many of them get harmed because of this unnecessary treatment, just on the you know, first floor of this argument, right, is the medical necessity argument, right? Forget about any unique vaccine-related complications. Just on the ground floor, we have medical necessity. If you're immune and you don't need the vaccine, you get the vaccine and you get harmed, that's harm. So you're talking about service members who are in harm's way, and our United States government and our White House, having been warned, is ignoring this idea. This is, to me, it's almost like a, you know, Biden's Benghazi, you know, really. I mean, it's like, you can't ignore this, right? You can't ignore it because you don't know or you don't think it's a problem. You know, there are enough people, very distinguished people like Dr. Peter McCullough. He's a full professor at Baylor, you know, he's been sounding the alarm similarly. He was on Fox News on Laura Ingraham and on Tucker again. And, you know, it's unfortunate that these folks are the only ones listening, but that's who's listening. And Dr. McCullough, who's a distinguished professor of medicine and cardiology, is stating exactly the same thing. So people are warning the administration and the CDC and the FDA. They're just not listening. You know, they just want to vaccinate everyone, you know, out the wazoo, if you will, you know, and that's not the way to do it.
So. Yeah. And I think it's probably important to point out right now, now that we're halfway through the interview, is that I believe you're vaccinated. I'm vaccinated. I never had my family has my daughter who's a freshman. Mm-hmm. I'll do that in air quotes because she's actually been home the whole time because of this dumb virus and just a dumb year. And that we'll get into that. But she never had COVID, but so she's getting the vaccine. And I think probably I would advocate people get vaccinated. I mean, I think it's your choice, but I think it's, I mean, I always say it's like getting vaccinated for the flu. I get vaccinated flu not because I'm worried about causing a global pandemic of flu spreading throughout my community. And maybe on some level, I should care about that more. But I do it because I really don't want to get the flu because it really sucks. And you're sick for a long time and you can't work and you feel miserable. And that's sort of my same thought with COVID, although I realize lots of people are asymptomatic or pretty much totally fine. I mean, is that your, I mean, that's your position, right? We're not, we're saying that COVID's not real, right?
No, you know, Eric, I have to actually apologize to you. I wanted to be very emphatic on the at the beginning of this interview, and I forgot to do this. And I do this with every interview I do. So, you know, I've been vaccinated. I got the Moderna vaccine, right? And I truly understand and know the power and efficacy of these vaccines. Not only, you know, as an immunologist, but you know, as someone who actually has received the vaccine and measured my own IgG levels. I measured my IgG levels before the vaccine. I had zero. I measured it after the vaccine, and my antibody levels for spike protein are off the charts. So I believe that these vaccines are highly effective. And to your point, in my own family, I have six children. My son, who's a freshman at the University of Chicago, he had COVID back in November. He was sick for 10 days. You know, he came home this past spring, and I measured his antibodies. And he's got a whopping amount of antibody. He's immune. His sister, who's 18 and is going to college next year, we measured her antibodies and she doesn't have antibodies, right? So she got vaccinated. But you know what? My son Joseph, there's no way in hell he's gonna get the vaccine. And you know, the University of Chicago can go ahead and, you know, try to mandate it. And what they'll get stuck with is a federal lawsuit, you know? So, and you know, I've already gone to the administration, and with all due respect, I mean, I really, it's a fantastic university. It's one of the top universities in the country, but if they can't exercise good judgment, you know, they've received all the warnings, they've received the lawyer letters, and all they need to do is mandate this vaccine and they'll end up with a federal lawsuit, you know? And if that's how we have to do it, that's how we'll do it. But, you know, the preferable way is, right? The preferable way is that we, people of intelligence and ethical standing and clinical standing and reason, get together and say, okay, look, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. It's not a big deal. We put a man on Mars or a rover on Mars and a man on the moon. We can exercise medical necessity here. We can adjudicate whether vaccination is medically necessary. If you have like 40% of your frontline healthcare workers having had COVID and are immune to this, these people should not be exposed to the risk of harm by an added vaccine, by an unnecessary medical treatment. This is a no-brainer, Eric. Something we should be, that we shouldn't be shouldn't be subject to controversy by Dr. Fauci or by Dr. Wen or by Dr. Walensky. I mean, these folks are really doing a disservice not only to the people who could get potentially harmed, but also by eroding trust in government and by eroding some of the core principles of our profession.
Yeah. Well, and it's certainly not difficult for a university. They can say, show proof of vaccination or proof of infection or serology. And I mean, they do that for all sorts of other things. They don't even have to be involved in the process, right? Just have some sort of, I don't know, whatever they use for portals now. It's all online. And I do appreciate the fact that we are so nerdy that you actually checked your IgG levels and of your kids. I mean, that's great.
I had less than 0.8 units per milliliter in my blood before the vaccination, which is the baseline threshold for the LabCorp test. And after my second Moderna shot, I had greater than 250 units per ml, which is the upper limit of detection. So yes, I did.
So now we're going to go to there's one other subject I want to talk about is now this week, I think they're going to start rolling out vaccinations for children down to the age of 12. And then at some point it'll be kids down to probably age of 2. I think that's where the trials are. And that may be happening in the fall. Do you have any sort of sense of what people should do as far as parents? Because parents are definitely more they're more concerned because it's one thing it's with just your life, but when you're making decisions for another, I mean, obviously it's different, right? You're more cautious and they're more hesitant with vaccines. What's your recommendation for down at age 12? I mean, is this like a figure out what the risk for COVID is versus the risk of the vaccine? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Do you think they need more antibody tests or what sort of other things?
So you know, for my own kids, I have kids ranging from 8 to 19. And I think my own age cutoff for my kids is probably 16. So my 16-year-old's probably going to get vaccinated. But below 16, I think, you know, and the reason is that the 16-year-old moves around a lot. You know, it's a less controlled sort of, you know, in terms of movement and susceptibility to acquiring the infection. But, you know, look, I think the risk currently for the variants that are out there, you know, the risk to children is astronomically low, right? And so it's probably true that the risk from the vaccine itself may be high, either on par or maybe even a little higher for the kids. So I don't really see any justification currently for giving the vaccine to the kids, but to the kids below the age of 12 or below the age of 16 rather. But I do think that one concern I have, and I think this is something that's bearing out in places like India, is that as more and more people, including kids, get naturally infected, the probability of a variant emerging that might actually be more harmful or more virulent increases, right? And you know, like I guess the thought experiment that I would ask you and your audience to do is imagine if SARS-CoV-2 were similar to the 1918 flu, where kids were actually being affected too. You know, I think we'd be having a completely different conversation, right? The fact that this virus is actually low virulency, right, and it affects people who are older and more susceptible, changes the calculus a little bit. Now, that's not to say that somewhere down the line a variant couldn't evolve that could affect kids. I mean, I've written about this, and I think it's just dumb luck that that's not the case, right? I mean, it's like there's going to be a sequence and a variation in the protein structures that could make it more virulent in kids and more damaging. And so the only rationale I would see for vaccinating kids is if that actually is a tangible thing, right? That if infect more people and you increase the burden of mutation in the population globally, that you could actually get to a point where kids could be affected. In that case, I would say that it's justified to vaccinate kids. But I don't think we have any evidence of that right now. It's going to be a hard sell to a lot of parents. And for myself, like I said, I would basically stick with 16 as my cutoff. And that's purely based on the fact that my 16-year-old is getting in her car and driving around to her friend's house and here and there. And so she's just more susceptible to catching it than my 12-year-old. So,
yeah. Yeah, that'll be a challenging question. And I feel like a lot of the arguments right now are you're vaccinating for population safety versus actual the safety for the child. And I don't think that's really ever been the focus of a vaccine. Like a vaccine is a very personal decision and a personal choice. And that I do recognize that from a population standpoint, you need to reach certain vaccination rates or immunity rates in order to prevent the spread of disease and viruses. But that's sort of like a secondary sort of effect of protecting yourself with a vaccine.
You know, I mean, I do think that there's the element of protecting yourself is definitely the case. I mean, you know, like I have antibodies and I'm protected. So it's sort of this sort of self-serving objective. But I also do think that there is sort of a duty and patriotic duty. And I use that knowing full well that a lot of people will find it distasteful. But you know, I mean, I do think that this idea that, look, if I'm infected, most likely I'll clear it by myself, or maybe I want to take a drug. But if I take that infection and give it to someone who's vulnerable and bring about that person's demise, then I've done something that's not publicly responsible. I haven't done my civic duty. Now, I mean, that argument I think does hold, right? I wouldn't, you know, based on just simply a probability that might happen, I wouldn't take someone's civil liberties away from them to shove it down their throat that they should get vaccinated, right? It's sort of like, yes, that's possible. That is an argument, and you can pose it to people, but you still can't use it as justification to force or coerce people to get it, right? And so, yes, I do believe that it's my civic duty to get vaccinated if I need to get vaccinated, if I'm not immune. Because if I catch this thing and I give it to my next-door neighbor's 80-year-old father, right, and he dies because of it, then that's on me, right? So for me, that is actually sort of an element of civic duty, and it does play into, you know, my sense of responsibility to my community and whether my kids should get vaccinated. But I don't, that's sort of my philosophical precept. It may not be yours or it may not be, you know, Joe Smith's. And in a pluralistic society, we are duty bound also fundamentally to respect other people's sort of approaches and ways of doing things, right? So I can't say that Joe Smith for sure is going to hurt somebody. There's a probability that he or she might, but I can't take civil liberties away from him based on a probability, you know.
Yeah, it is a persuasive argument, right? It's a you know, this is another reason to do it, but it may not persuade you as an individual that you feel compelled that benefit outweighs the risk from whatever you perceive it as. And as parents, as I mentioned in the last episode, which has not yet been released, we are left in charge of our children with imperfect information and and no knowledge of the future. And so that's where we are. So I want to shift gears a little bit. And this is a question I have. Now that I've got immunology, I absolutely have to ask this question because I hear this all the time. I'm not entirely convinced. When you look at flu rates in the country, and not even this country, the entire world, the flu has just disappeared. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to most people about regular upper respiratory infections for probably, you know, adenovirus, rhinovirus, and the other coronavirus variants, people are, you know, not getting sick. And so what do you think the explanation is for the flu just completely disappearing? Because I know there are conspiracy theorists who say, well, it's because it's, you know, the same thing or whatever. I mean, that's not even possibly remotely true, but clearly there's just no flu. And, is it because of all the mitigation measures we're using with schools and things like that? Because if that's the case, it's not working for COVID. I'm kind of curious.
I think that's basically what it is. So the difference between the SARS-CoV-2 and the flu and some of the other endemic viruses is the size of the magnitude of the problem, if you will, right? So in other words, you know, yes, the mitigation measures have actually served to tamp down SARS-CoV-2 as well. There's no question. If you lock down like China did, right, that you can reduce down the incidence of SARS-CoV-2 to zero, right? And so those same mitigation measures will work on flu and adenovirus and all those other infectious diseases. It's just that the magnitude of those problems is so much smaller normally that when you actually come down and you with this iron fist and you just like lock everything down, those diseases are much more susceptible to disappearing than the big mushroom that's grown around us, which is SARS-CoV-2. So I think I'm trying to think of a good analogy for that. Thanks for raising this, because it actually is making my wheels turn in terms of what the analogy would be. But I just think it's sort of the pandemic virus is a much bigger and more frequent infectious organism in the world right now compared to flu and adenovirus. And so when you come down and you put down this iron sort of fist down and you just like do a blanket, you know, shutdowns and mitigation measures, the smaller problems are going to disappear much more quickly because they're smaller. And so what we're seeing is that those diseases have disappeared because they're subject to the same mitigation force that SARS-CoV-2 is. It's just that SARS-CoV-2 is so much bigger that it's just sort of, it's staying around. So
do you think it's a lot related to the fact that at any one time people have immunity to those various viruses? And so the available fuel for these viruses is much smaller to begin with, whereas COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, everybody sort of like initially was a, you know, potential target.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the difference between an endemic and a pandemic virus, right? I mean, a pandemic virus is, it takes off like a wildfire because more people are susceptible to it, right? Whereas an endemic virus, number one, you know, the vast majority of the world's population is sort of immune to it. And so really it's happening at a relatively low frequency compared to SARS-CoV-2. So you have a massive load of virus in the form of SARS-CoV-2, and you have a very, very small load of virus relatively with respect to flu and adenovirus, and all of these are basically spreading with the same mechanism. So movement, travel, you know, contact, those are that's how these viruses spread. So when you limit that significantly, as we have around the world, what you get is the smaller problem disappearing almost, whereas the bigger problem still sticks around.
Yeah, and that makes sense because totally. And then finally, when Dave Graham and I talk about the evolution of the coronavirus, so he looks at it, he says, well, let's look at a previous virus that came to, OC43 is, I think, the most recent one that jumped from, they would believe, cows to humans, late 1800s maybe, you know, not entirely sure, but you kind of read some reports and news, because it's amazing how things have changed in only 130 years as far as understanding of things. And you wonder what sort of people's response would be back then if they had all the technology we have and the understanding of immunology and whatever. But and that what's going to happen to this coronavirus? It will become endemic. It clearly is already on the way. It's all over the world. We're going to have it around forever. There are already animal reservoirs, it sounds like, in mice and mink, and probably some other mammals will be found to have. So unless we euthanize all the mink and mice, we'll always have exposure.
The Danish did, right? Didn't the Danish go through a phase where like they wiped out?
I think the Belgians. I think the Belgians, but yeah. Well, somewhere one of those guys out in Europe.
One of those Nordic countries, yeah.
I shouldn't say that because my wife's Danish, so I should be careful. but when it comes to subsequent infection, so when you look at infections of OC43, it looks like you can get OC43 infections throughout your life, that you will have I don't want to say temporary immunity, but maybe that's probably the best way of saying it, that you have, you're immune for a while, and then you can get it, but you never get probably as sick, and it just becomes an upper respiratory infection, and it doesn't cause massive inflammations like you get from this sort of novel SARS-CoV-2. Dave's expectation is that this will very much follow the same pathway, meaning that once you've had it, you've got some T cell immunity, you've got some latent immunity, that you may lose your antibodies because coronaviruses seem to be pretty good at evading the immune system over time, but that subsequent infections will be less severe, and that'll be basically a common cold at some point. And especially kids today, by the time they're in our age, this will be no big deal. It'll be circulating like normal, and we won't even pay any attention to it. Do you think that's a reasonable expectation? Because you read the New York Times and they're like, we're going to need booster shots every 3 years because people are going to lose their antibodies, and we're going to have to deal with this for the rest of our lives, and, you know, for the foreseeable future. That seems less likely to me as a possible scenario. What do you think?
So I mean, it's a really good question. I think obviously your colleague or your friend's perspective is sort of the optimistic perspective, right? And I don't sort of view it from the perspective of sort of a teleological sort of approach to the question, which could either be optimistically teleological or pessimistically teleological. And when I say teleological, I mean like you start with the premise that it's going to be a disaster, or you start with the premise that it's going to be just fine, no problem, right? I think the reality is that billions of people are naturally infected, and there are mutations happening randomly in every individual who's infected, and the variants are coming not from out of thin air; they're coming out of naturally infected people who are mutating the genetic code of the coronavirus. And so what's going to happen is as we develop sort of global immunity, if you will, to this virus, there's also going to be a repertoire of viruses, of variants that are going to be out there now, right? And so some of them are going to be more or less virulent, you know, some of them. You know, and so I think it's going to be a big problem potentially to dig out of, and it really is going to be a random process, right? But where you have a repertoire of coronaviruses out there now because we were exposed to this pandemic, and the scope of it is going to be much worse than I think than the flu pandemic, because in the 1918 flu we weren't as mobile, so not as many of the world's population were as rapidly sort of infected with the 1918 flu. So I think there is concern that some of these random mutations will lead to variants that could be potentially more destructive. So I do think there's an argument for limiting the number of people who get naturally infected, either through vaccination or through lockdowns. I do think that could be a problem. Whether it'll be an okay problem, like your friend thinks, or whether it'll be like a disaster, like some other people assume, I don't think we shouldn't adjudicate it that way. We should say, look, you know, what's happening right now, I don't know if you've studied Stephen Jay Gould's work in evolutionary biology, but he introduced this concept of punctuated equilibrium. And what punctuated equilibrium is when during the course of evolution, you have these periods of equilibrium where selective forces are working on different variants, right, of whatever, right? And those selective forces in the environment guide what will be, right? And then there are these periods of punctuation where variants are either expanding or contracting rapidly because of some cataclysmic thing like a pandemic, right? So right now we're at a period of punctuation with respect to this virus where the natural infections are generating a lot of variants, right? And I do think that there's an argument actually for limiting those natural infections, either be it through the vaccine or through sort of social cultural measures, right? The Chinese have obviously been successful at using their state machinery to block natural infection and transmission. We can't do that in Western democracies because of our structure. We just can't do it, right? So I think our solution is the vaccine, right? But So I'm a big advocate for using this vaccine to limit natural infection. Really, I mean, I think we should deploy this vaccine as efficiently, as quickly as possible on as many people as possible to limit the rate of natural infection. I just think we can do it rationally, you know, and safely.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at Australia and New Zealand, who have an approach that is, I think, similar in some ways to China. I mean, they've sort of like walled off their country. I mean, I guess it's the benefit of being an island. I suppose you can do do what you want. Well,
you know, the Israelis, Eric, the Israelis, you know, the reason why they were able to do that study that I pointed to, which showed that naturally immune people and the vaccine infected people are equally protected. The reason why they could do that study, right, is because in Israel, they were very, you know, they're very much on top of it. They screened everyone, and they literally, their policy, their public health policy was they weren't vaccinating people who were infected. And that's how they could tell that there's a, look, here we have this pile of people we didn't vaccinate that were naturally infected, and here's this pile of people we vaccinated because they weren't infected. And they're basically the same. They're behaving the same in terms of susceptibility. So they actually use that intelligent sort of approach, and we can too. I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't.
I think there's people who think there's a benefit to getting further exposures to the virus or any sort of viral infection. Like once you've been immunized, say measles, that you get exposed to measles occasionally throughout your lifetime, and that it boosts your immune system and you have a stronger immunity to that in the population. Do you think that's the same in COVID? And if so, you know, do you think that would be the argument to say, well, that's why I think I had COVID a year ago, I should still get the vaccine, right?
That's a reasonable argument. I mean, look from an immunological perspective, you know, I think the idea of getting boosters is actually scientifically based, right? So you can actually, you know, you can booster. Now, some viruses, as you know, like the chickenpox virus, once you get chickenpox, you have lifetime immunity. And we know that based on a vast clinical experience for many, many years, right? We don't know where SARS-CoV-2 is going to fall in that. So it is possible that, you know, you would get a vaccine. And I actually, you know, I don't mind, like, if for example, my son who had COVID in November, let's say next November, measure his antibodies and they've dropped down. I don't mind if he gets a booster shot, you know? I think it's rational, you know, you just sort of boost that immunity and make sure it sticks. So because we don't know, you know, how long it's going to last. If to guess, I would say that in the majority of people who have natural infections, it's going to last for quite some time.
Okay.
But that's just a guess, right?
Yeah. Right. Well, we're all, and that's the problem. People ask you, and you can't know because you don't have the benefit of time, right? Yeah. We're only a year into this.
What you can say is, look, you know, what you can say is, I will measure my antibody titers. And when my antibody titers start to drop by more than, say, 25%, I'll start thinking about getting the booster. Yeah. You know, it's sort of a rational, empiric thing to do. And I think it's based on clinical science and based on scientific experience. And I think that it's rational. I mean, we do that all the time. We use our clinical judgment, right, in the face of uncertainty to make decisions, right? You know, not everything is the sort of Atul Gawande checklist manifesto bullshit. Right. It's like, you don't work at McDonald's. Right. We have clinical experience. We have judgment. Right. And those are intangible. And I can tell you, like, I've interacted with surgeons who are very sort of like algorithmic, like robots, and people who are, I'm sure you have too. You've seen anesthesiologists who have this gut feeling about something, and that gut feeling always, always saves the day. To the guy who's just following the checklist manifesto like a robot, right, and is killing people in left and right, you know. So I think there's room here in the face of uncertainty for judgment, clinical wisdom, scientific extrapolation, and prognostication. And this idea that we overrule and override anyone who says, "Oh, there's a prognosticated problem here." Like I can't tell you. There's this guy. He's a surgeon at Wayne State, David Gorski. You know, he got on my case early on in this whole thing. About why are you prognosticating gloom and doom about the vaccine, right? And literally, he unleashed this group of like lay people who are his
Twitter mob
minions, I guess, right? To just literally throw eggs, right? I mean, literally, it went all the way to the point where someone had taken a post and sent it to the state medical board, you know, complaining that my license should be rewritten. It's like, well, okay, so first of all, that's like bully tactics, right? You can't do that. That's not appropriate, right? It's like, you know, I'm not saying people shouldn't get vaccinated. I'm saying that we have some safety concerns here, right? And but this idea that any sort of skepticism or dissent gets squashed in this whole discourse, that if you deviate from the institutional and public health narrative, somehow you're either an anti-vaxxer or you have some nefarious intent, you know, for our national security, is so detrimental to everything that we represent. I mean, I'll tell you one other anecdote, and then I don't want to take too much of your time, but you know, I when I first published my letter to Pfizer, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has been labeled as this pariah of the anti-vaccine sort of monstrosity, right? Nothing could be further from the truth. When you talk to the guy, he's completely reasonable and rational and a decent human being. You know, his publication picked took up my letter from to Pfizer and to FDA and published it in The Defender. The Defender is, you know, the Children's Health Defense's publication. I had no problem with that. You know, I put this thing in the public domain. I have no problem. Anyone could pick it and read it and amplify it. I'm happy about that. And I'm happy about the discourse. Then this guy Gorski, you know, at Wayne State, goes in and activates his whole machinery trying to label me as an anti-vaxxer, which, you know, that's not the way it works. You know, the way it works in our country is that we engage in discourse and we operate based on ethics and decency, and we're not bullies. You know, we don't bully each other around. You know, crowds don't go beating up on individuals. We don't use our state machinery to beat someone up and take away their livelihood. You know, none of that shit, you know. So anyway, that's where we are.
Yeah. Well, I wish that was all entirely true, but definitely the last couple of years have made me question some things as far as what I thought were. I think we talked about it before show. I think just the intellectual curiosity and scientific curiosity seems to be lacking in some ways, which is a little worrisome. But I think it's, you know, I think these things will work themselves out. I also think, like, the vaccine passports. I think the this recognition that once you've been infected, you have to get vaccinated. I think you'll soon see an end to those arguments in the next month or two. That's optimistic, but I tend to think that people who are we're helped in this country because we have a federal system. We have various states doing their own things that fight the federal government, and so you can get different narratives and different examples of things that work and don't work. And I think that helps us in this country, at least with a debate, that you can say, well, you know, you're doing this, it doesn't seem to be helping, or, you know. And so I think we're seeing that, and I think we'll get the same thing when it comes to these other measures. That's my hope.
But, I hope so. I mean, yeah, I think you're right, and you know, there's a lot of reason to hope, and I actually think that most of it centers on the common sense of the American people. I think it's very easy as experts and sort of people with specialized, titles and expertise to undermine the common sense of this democracy. But I think in the end, it's going to steer things. It doesn't look pretty. Democracy in America doesn't look pretty, but I think ultimately it sort of figures out the common denominator and actually makes the right decision. So,
yeah, that's my hope as well. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I really appreciate the conversation. Where's a good place for people to find your stuff? It'll all be linked at theparadox.com so people can find stuff there, but where's a good place? I mean, obviously Twitter, that's where I found you, but you write at Medium and other places.
Yeah. So Eric, I'm not a very sophisticated social media guy. I mean, I do use Twitter, you know, and I find it pretty useful and good for discourse. I'm also on Facebook, and everything on my Facebook is public, and you can just put my name in. And I write on medium.com. So it's my last name, Norchash, NORCHASHM.medium.com. And my Twitter link is at Norchashm, NORCHASHM. So, you know, I welcome, you know, anyone in the public to actually go on there and sort of throw eggs at me or not, you know, or send me some love. You know, it doesn't matter which way you go. You know, so it's
Nice. Dr. Norchashm, thank you so much for being on The Paradox. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Eric. It's nice being here.
Thanks again to Dr. Hooman Norchashm for the great show and discussion about vaccinations and immunity. But before we end, don't forget to reach out to MR Insurance and Consultants, where their goal is to assist physicians in obtaining the most comprehensive coverage available to fit their unique situation. Reach out for both excellent and quality service at drpodcastnetwork.com/MRinsurance.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher, and share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.